KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome. Sorry to interrupt this conversation. A good part of what we like to do with these gatherings is bring people together and let you all sit with your colleagues and have a chance to chat about what you're doing and share ideas. And I'm very sorry to interrupt that process. But we do have some presentations today, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time for all of you to ask questions afterwards. My name is Vicki Rideout, and I'm a vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and I'm the director of our program for the study of entertainment media and health. And thank you all for joining us here today for our forum on assessing the effectiveness of public education campaigns. As you may know, the Kaiser Family Foundation has been involved with public education campaigns for almost a decade now, particularly in the area of HIV awareness and prevention. And these campaigns are run by my colleagues Matt James, Tina Hoff, Julia Davis, Meredith Michelle, and Stephen Massey. Like everyone else in this field, we're constantly asking ourselves whether we're getting enough return on our investment, whether we're having the impact that we want to, and what we can do to do a better job. These days, it seems like policymakers and others are increasingly turning to media-based public education campaigns as a way of addressing a whole range of public health issues and other problems facing the nation, from substance abuse to childhood obesity to teen pregnancy and so on. And among the topics that we're going to be addressing here today are, is this likely to be an effective approach? What can we realistically expect campaigns like this to accomplish? What can we learn from past campaigns to make these new efforts as effective as they can be? And how should we judge success, particularly when it comes to taxpayer-funded campaigns, but also for all of us? How do we judge success? Now, many of these efforts are undertaken by people in this room. Pretty much everybody here either conducts a public education campaign on a health-related issue or is thinking about doing so. And so the purpose of this forum is really simply to give those of us doing this kind of work the chance to hear firsthand from researchers who've conducted some of the most recent and most powerful studies evaluating public education campaigns, which we don't always get a chance to hear about directly from the researchers, and to give you the opportunity to ask whatever questions you may have directly of those who conducted the research and see how what they've done can help inform what all of you may be doing in the months and years ahead. The format for today is that we're going to hear brief presentations from each of our researchers, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. So as you're listening, please keep your questions in mind, and we'll be sure to save plenty of time for you to ask them. There will be people with microphones coming through so that everybody can hear you. At this point, I'm going to introduce the entire panel of presenters. To my far right is Donna Vallone, Associate Vice President for Research at the American Legacy Foundation. Donna directs all of the foundation's research and evaluation efforts, and she's a public health scientist with more than 10 years of experience in applied research and program evaluation. Next to Donna is Seth Knorr, Professor Seth Knorr from the University of Kentucky. Dr. Knorr has collaborated on several large-scale evaluation projects, and he recently authored a 10-year retrospective of research in health mass media campaigns, a copy of which is in your packets. And he's going to be presenting the results of his recent two-city safer sex campaign in Lexington, Kentucky and Knoxville, Tennessee. And to my immediate right is Marion Heumann. Marion leads the evaluation of the CDC's VERB campaign, which is a physical fitness campaign aimed at 9 to 12-year-olds. And she oversees the formative research for the campaign. She supervises a continuous tracking survey that monitors the VERB brand among their target audience, and she directs a nationally representative longitudinal survey of children and their parents, which is conducted, I believe, annually. And we're going to start with Marion. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Marion Heumann.
Thank you, Vicki. So glad to be here.
As you know, some of what we're talking about today is, well, one of the things is addressing childhood obesity. And as you also know, with overweight problems, it's an equation of calories in and calories out. So the VERB campaign is a national mass media intervention to encourage children 9 to 13 to be physically active every day. So we are addressing the calories burned side of the equation for childhood weight. VERB is a branded campaign. VERB is not an acronym. It is the grammatical word for action. It's what you do. It has become Kids Brand for Physical Activity. It was launched in 2002. It targets all U.S. tweens, so it's national in scope. And by multi-ethnic, I mean that we have hired a general market advertising agency contractor as well as four ethnic contractors that are specific for ethnic audiences, and they help. They design their own messages and their own advertising, and buy their own media that best meets the needs of their target audience. Parents are a secondary audience. Our main audience is tweens 9 to 13, and this campaign ends, closes the doors, turns out the lights, September 30th, 2006. But we do have a full campaign out there we have had for the whole year and are continuing for the summer, and I'll just tell you a little bit about that in a minute. One of the reasons that VERB is so expensive is that we use paid media. And one of the reasons that it has been successful and has such high awareness is that it uses paid media. So I wanted to show you an example of paid media. Take me just, a second. This was from an earlier, 2 years ago.
Hey, looking for a VERB? How about bounce?
I love this VERB. What I do?
So what VERB are you going to do? For more info, it'd be okay to go online and check out verbnow.com. VERB, it's what you do.
Okay, that's a good example of where we also use celebrity talent. So that was Tracy McGrady with that. Very high action, lots of color. We're a lot more than paid media, though. We do a lot of what's called experiential marketing, so event, guerrilla marketing, street teams. And the idea of that is trying to let kids sample the product of physical activity. So we go to fairs, we have these vans that go around and set up at day camps and give kids a chance to sample the brand. We also do a great deal of school and community programs and promotions. So we're, again, more than media. We have these quick in-and-out, two-week kinds of promotions where we give kits to the schools, and they have pedometers in them, and they have incentives, and they have premiums in them, all those kinds of things. Quick in, quick out. You don't want something up in the middle school, like a VERB poster, for too long because it becomes boring and part of what could be a kind of an uninteresting school experience. So we really instruct the schools how to do those. Our phase four messaging focuses on, it's called Sunshine Campaign. So the paid ads, which I'm not going to show you, the TV ads, feature kids outside holding the sun, and the idea is soak up the fun, soak up the sun. It's our most integrated campaign with our community promotion, and that's because the community promotion uses a yellow ball. It should be bigger than this. This one fit in my suitcase, but they blow this up. The idea of the VERB yellow ball is there are instructions on here. There's a number on here. The kids are, we have distributed over 100,000 of these throughout the United States. And it's a real good example of a viral marketing campaign. And what we're trying to do is these kids log in this number on the VERB now yellowball.com yellow ball website. Then they play with it, then they pass it on, and then they go on the website, and they can follow that yellow ball and where their own little yellow ball and where it has gone next. So it looks like the sun, and like I said, it was came up with by two of the different contracting agencies, so they it's a really well-integrated campaign. I'm so glad to share with you about our outcome evaluation, because we are challenged by this evaluation by some of the most rigorous and demanding researchers in the field of evaluations of media campaigns. So we are always looking to see whether or not we believe our effects and can help other people believe our effects. Basically, we're trying to see what's our awareness and the reach of the messages, and then are we moving the needle on attitudes, social norms, and physical activity behaviors itself. When we started planning the Verb campaign evaluation in 2001, there really wasn't a lot out there about media campaign effects. Some information from some of the state campaigns, Florida and Vermont, for smoking, but nothing out there for kid physical activity. There were some adult international campaigns for physical activity, but they were not showing behavioral effects. So we really didn't know what we could expect. Our design, as Vicki said, is a national longitudinal design. It is not a post-only evaluation. It is a pre-post evaluation, and we use the baseline that was started before there was any advertising out there to control for these longitudinal effects we're going to see at follow-up. So our baseline started in 2002. It's a nationally represented sample, uses a survey, children 9 to 13, and one of their parents, and we measure all kinds of activities, attitudes, and behaviors. The analysis uses propensity scoring, which is a little bit different technique than a lot of people are familiar with, and it's one of the ways that we can control for the largest amount of covariates and as closely as possible attribute the effects to the campaign, to Verb itself. We put upon ourselves a standard. We wanted to be able to see if there were significant differences between children unaware of Verb and all children in the United States, as well as an association between the level of awareness and the outcome. So that's, in media campaigns, it's kind of an important attribute of effect. If you can see that as the advertising increases, the effects increase. It's kind of a dose response effect. We didn't quite get the dose quite right in the first year, and then we've modified the evaluation for the second year. Okay, in terms of what we found then, most of what I'm sharing with you today is the first year results in 2003, but this is awareness in 2003 and 2004. Our goal in the first year was a 50% awareness. That's what our creative agency said that they thought we could expect. We far exceeded that with a 74% awareness. That includes 57% aided awareness and 17% unaided, and then 72% in 2004. So our awareness is doing great, and our creative agency said, you've hit a home run. That's a lot of hamburgers in our world. So we were also concerned about understanding of the messages. What were kids actually taking away from the campaign? The first year, we had 90% of kids that had an understanding of the key messages of the campaign. In the second year, 96%. So what about behavioral effects? We looked at physical activity for free time physical activity and for organized physical activity, but the campaign was really targeting free time physical activity. So we got effects in free time physical activity in three major subgroups in younger children, 9 to 10 years of age. And as you look at this graph that's up there, you see the little 1.1, so it's a 1.1 session difference. And the column furthest to the left is children unaware of Verb. So they did weekly 3.2 sessions of physical activity compared to all 9 to 10-year-olds, which did 4.3 sessions. That included the unaware and the aware. So 1.1 session difference, which was significant. We got effects in younger and also in girls, which was particularly gratifying because girls are really vulnerable for physical activity, really drop their physical activity off as they go into their adolescent years. So you'll see that the column to the left was 2.6 sessions of girls unaware of Verb compared to 3.3 sessions, a 0.7 session difference. We also got effects in this low to middle income group. And that was about a 1.1 session difference in that $25,000 to $50,000 household. I told you that we also wanted to look at a sort of a dose response effect. And so we got this awareness and association between awareness and outcomes effect, again, in younger kids, target of the campaign, and also a total effect. That's the group of columns over there to the right as you're looking at it. Now, How much time do I have? I'm doing fine. Okay, good. Because let me show you a little bit more about this graph. As you look at the set of four columns, the group of columns, let's just look at the 9 to 10 years. So that's the children, again, that are unaware of verb. That second group are a group that said they had recall, but they didn't understand the campaign. So they were actually a little bit lower. The next group is our largest group. Those are children that had awareness of the campaign after they were prompted about, have you heard of a campaign or advertising for getting kids active? Have you heard of verb? But the group to the farthest right, that 5.6 sessions of physical free time activity, is kids that are high, what we call high aware. So they had unprompted awareness of the campaign. So this is a trend line then that goes from across those four groups and shows that, although it doesn't look perfectly, but statistically, as you increased your level or your richness of awareness about the campaign, the children's sessions of physical activity increased. So that is, as I said earlier, is another criteria of effect that we set for ourselves and which we were really pleased with. Got the same thing with girls again. So even though, as you're looking at those group of columns to the left, that 3.8 sessions is our largest group again, and that's a little bit higher. But across the trend, across all four of them, was a significant effect. It looks like it would have been significant for boys, but it was not. We also got an association between awareness and outcomes for two income groups, the households of less than 25,000, which we're really pleased with, because often the burden of and problems is often with these lower income families. They have less resources for getting organized sports, their kids to organize sports. They have transportation barriers. They have a lot of barriers. So we're pleased with that. And then also in the 50 to 75,000 household income category. So in summary of our behavioral effects then, nationally, free time, physical activity, weekly sessions was for younger children, for girls, and children of households earning 25 to 50,000, and then an association of effects with dose of messaging in the same groups or in similar groups. So that's all. Thank you very much. Take my yellow ball with me.
Thank you, Marian, and please join me now in welcoming Professor Seth Knorr.
All right, hello, everyone. Good to be here. Thank you, Vicki, and thanks again for the opportunity to be here and interact with folks. Well, today I'm going to present the effects of a two-city Safer Sex media campaign targeting high sensation-seeking and impulsive decision-making young adults. Probably the longest title of any of the speakers here. And I want to just quickly acknowledge our research team. Rick Zimmerman is actually the PI, the principal investigator on the project, sort of the head of the project. Phil Palmgreen is our co-PI. We have some co-investigators and some graduate research assistants. So we had a large research team working on this project. And the project was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. Well, the research question that we asked in this project was, can a standalone televised mass media campaign be effective in changing safer sexual behavior? This is an important question for at least a couple of reasons. One is there's a skepticism in a lot of circles that a media campaign at all can be effective in changing behavior, or a multi-component campaign. It's also important because a lot of campaigns we see these days have multiple components. And our purpose here was to look at a media-only, actually a television-only campaign, to see if that could actually have behavioral effects. One of the things that we tried to respond to in this project was some limitations of previous campaigns. Take off my watch so I keep an eye. Okay. And so some of the campaigns you're going to hear about today don't have most of these limitations. Unfortunately, a lot of campaigns out there do. And some of the ones you see most widely have to do with lack of formative research to really understand the target audience, the kind of messages that may be effective, the kind of channels that you should put your messages in or the kind of outlets, a lack of audience segmentation and targeting messages to those audience segments. Failure to develop theory-based campaigns, although in this recent review I conducted, I found that more and more campaigns seem to be utilizing theory. And most of all, the one I'm going to focus most on today has to do with rigorous evaluation. Unfortunately, the health mass media campaign literature has not tended to use strong evaluation designs. And so we have volumes of studies, but those studies altogether don't tell us nearly as much as they could about do these campaigns work. Are we spending our resources and our money in the right place, or are we not? So the current study, we tried to take what essentially are effective principles of campaign design really strongly into account in this campaign. So the purpose was to develop and implement and evaluate a two-city media campaign. This was focused on safer sex, and the message in the campaign was trying to persuade folks to increase their condom use. The medium that we used were televised 30-second public service announcements, sort of the standard 30-second PSAs, and we focused on at-risk heterosexually active young adults. And as I'll explain here, the design that we used was a controlled interrupted time series design. We had two small cities, small to medium-sized cities, Lexington, Kentucky, Knoxville, Tennessee. This is the part of the country where I'm at, University of Kentucky, so that was one reason we were there. These two cities were actually used by Dr. Phil Palmgreen in some previous research. They're very similar cities to one another. They both have, Lexington has University of Kentucky, Knoxville has University of Tennessee. They're both kind of big college towns. So this will give a little sense of what our evaluation design looked like. As folks probably know, you can't really do a true experiment typically with media campaigns. So you have to use some kind of quasi-experimental design. This is one of the strongest designs we believe that can be used. So what happens here is we've got the two cities. One city will get a campaign. In this case, Lexington got the televised campaign. One city serves as a comparison community. That was Knoxville. They're very similar in a number of ways. And what we did here with the time series design is to collect data each month from May 2002 all the way through January 2004. And we collect samples each month, and I'll explain a little bit more on the next slide about that. And what happens, as you can see, is in January, February, and March of 2003, there was a campaign just in one of the cities. It was actually about a 13-week campaign. and so what we have here is a bunch of data before the campaign. The campaign happens, a bunch of data after the campaign, so we can see what happens in the one city. We can also compare it to the city that did not have a campaign. And so this is a time series design. We can get a sense not only of pre-post, but we can also get a sense of what's the secular trend, what's the developmental trend. Because too often we assume in these kinds of campaigns, oh, the behavior is just flat. It's just flattened out, and our campaign is going to hit and do something. Well, almost every time series study I've ever seen, the behavior is not flat. When you're coming in, the smoking is going up, or you're coming in, condom use is coming down. And if you aren't aware of that, you can't really as accurately and precisely interpret your results. So the way this worked is we did random samples of 100 individuals per month. These were different people at each month and the way that it works is you essentially are following a cohort month by month, so you kind of up their age slightly each month in the people that you're surveying. So at the beginning of the study they were aged 18 to 24, at the end they were aged 20 to 26. And we did the surveys using laptop computers. We used survey research centers at each university. And a nice advantage, there's a lot, number of advantages of that, including randomizing questions and things like that. One of the great advantages is we actually show them the PSAs so that when we get data on exposure, it should be much more accurate than, for instance, if we ask them over the telephone, because they actually watch it and then we ask them questions about it. And actually, if I had thought of it, I would have tried to get at least one PSA in here, but didn't think of it. So in terms of our campaign plan, these are some of the things we tried to do in terms of taking into account principles of effective campaign design. Phil Palmgreen and folks at University of Kentucky have done a lot of work with sensation seekers and targeting high sensation seekers, and we use an approach similar to that. We did a lot of formative research. I'm not going to say much about that today, but just to let you know, we did lots of focus groups with previously existing PSAs as well as original scripts that we developed. We used theory, and I'll explain that a little bit. And, of course, we tried to have a rigorous evaluation. Well, in terms of this sensation-seeking targeting approach called Centaur, the way that that works is we focused on high sensation seekers and also a group we call impulsive decision makers. These are both of these kinds of folks have been shown to engage in riskier sexual behaviors as compared to folks that are low sensation seekers and more rational decision makers. And so what we did is we developed and selected messages that were possibly effective with these folks. One thing we did actually is we reached out to the Kaiser Family Foundation because we did a lot of focus groups and found that, frankly, we found that most of the PSAs that we collected as many condom use PSAs as we could, and we went through and we did a lot of focus groups, and most of them, frankly, were terrible. Many of them were not very good. There were only a small number that tested pretty well in our focus groups, some very well, and those happened to be Kaiser. So we reached out to Kaiser, and they allowed us to use some of those spots in our actual campaign. We also developed 5 original PSAs, working with some folks. And all in all, the campaign had about 11 spots. So what we do then is we place these PSAs in programming preferred by the young adults. So one thing the literature has shown that is that the average campaign has pretty low exposure. And if you have low exposure, you have very little chance of your campaign working. We did a lot of formative research looking at what kinds of shows do these high sensation-seeking young adults watch, what kinds of programs, so we can insert them in those particular programs and get high exposure. And then when the campaign's evaluated, we focus on those high sensation seekers and impulsive decision makers. In terms of the airing of the campaigns, this is a sensitive area, safer sexual behavior. My guess is that anti-smoking, anti-drug kinds of campaigns probably have a little more luck because there seems to be less controversy over airing those kinds of spots. In fact, in Lexington, when we were talking to some of the stations, they said something about condom use advertisements that they really didn't like when Trojan would come around and try and buy airtime, and they would sort of hide from them. Because living in Kentucky now, it's a little bit more of a conservative part of the country than in the Northeast where I'm from. And so what we did is and I think really made a difference, we worked with the stations early on. The project was funded, and like a month or two later, we were meeting with the television stations and talking with them and showing them the kinds of spots that would be likely to show in the campaign. We shared with them the scripts that we were developing. We didn't want to go out and shoot a spot and then have them watch it and say, we can't air this. So we tried to bring them in as partners, and I think that made a big difference. In fact, some people are still, when I present this or others present this, some people are still surprised that we aired all these spots in Lexington and Knoxville on increasing condom use. In terms of the airtime, we heard about paid airtime. excuse me. What we did in this campaign is we were able to achieve a one-to-one match. So we had funds to buy airtime because the only way to get good airtime is to at least pay for some of it, at least through our model. But what we did is our media buyer worked with the stations and said, in order to be in this project, you have to give them a one-to-one match. So for every spot we bought, we got a free one, and we really made a strong pitch that it'd be good airtime and not be at 3 o'clock in the morning on the Lifetime channel or whatever. It's something that folks are not going to watch. They had that. We gave them the data and everything on what was important, and so we really tried to push to that. I already talked about where they were inserted, and then here's a little bit about the theoretical sort of message sequence. What we did was it was a 13-week campaign, about 3 weeks per topic. So we focused on threat, trying to raise the threat of STDs, HIV. Then we tried to personalize the risk. We tried to raise and focus on the benefits of condom use and consequences, and then we also tried to put across some skills, negotiation skills, and other kinds of skills. And we did have high saturation campaign, over 200 gross rating points, GRPs, per week. Okay, now I'm going to move quickly to results, because I'm going just a tad too slow here. For all the results, the focus of the analysis is on those above the median, so the high sensation seekers and impulsive decision makers are the folks that we focused on. I'm going to talk about exposure to the campaign, change in sexual risk behavior, and change in mediating variables. In terms of exposure, in terms of this is folks that saw at least one PSA, we had very high exposure. As you can see, when the campaign began, we had something like 68% exposure, and that quickly shot up to close to 100% of folks saw one of the ads, at least one of the ads. This next one here is looking at three different PSAs. A lot of different ways to look at exposure. This is three different PSAs. How many folks saw three different ones? This actually has two things tracked on it, high sensation seekers and lows. And both groups actually ended up seeing a lot of the spots, but we were pretty happy with the exposure. At the high point here during the campaign, it's about 80% saw three different PSAs. So we had pretty good exposure, not only reaching people, but also frequency, allowing them to see it multiple times. Okay, now to behavioral results. This is to start with the comparison community. This is Knoxville. And doesn't look like much is going on here. Pretty much a flat line. You can see it's drawn in there where the campaign happened in Lexington, because what we want to make sure is there wasn't any sort of crossover into Lexington or any kind of effect that happened there since it's our comparison. We were a little bit surprised by this trend. We had really expected economies to be decreasing because these folks are getting older. They're entering into intimate relationships. Unfortunately, one thing we know is they start using condoms less and using hormonal birth control instead. So we were a little bit surprised with this trend for that reason. This is the Lexington data, and this is more what we expected. If you look at the line coming down before the campaign, you see it's decreasing each month, which is kind of what we expected. And then the campaign happens, and what this is a line fitted by a computer. It's a time series regression analysis. And what happens here is that sort of upturn is statistically significant, and this is past three-month condom use. So you see condom use is coming down. When the campaign happened, it started to go up, and then we had a wear-off effect, which you see with just about any campaign where it started to come back down again. This slide here is just both of those trends put together on the same slide, and so you can see them sort of one against the other, where we had very different secular trends, but our view is that the campaign did impact condom use and obviously didn't in Knoxville. One there. We actually plotted, you know, what would have happened if there wasn't a campaign, and that sort of light gray line is what is projected if there wasn't a campaign, so condom use is projected to have continued to come down, and there wouldn't have been that sort of uptick. And a couple slides here on a couple mediating variables, self-efficacy, which has to do with do people perceive that they have the ability, the confidence to be able to use condoms in different kinds of challenging situations. And we got a similar pattern to behavior. We also measured intention to use condoms in the future, and we got a similar pattern in both cities. A little bit on magnitude of effects. So are these large effects? Are they small effects? Well, a recent review of campaigns showed that in the safer sex area, there have only been very tiny effects in campaigns. An R of about 0.04 is this effect size metric they used. Our study has an R of about 0.13. Another way to say that is that we estimate that an average young adult engaged in 10.49 fewer acts of unprotected intercourse because of the campaign. And when you multiply that out because of the wide reach of mass media, it reached over 20,000 young adults. We estimate that 181,224 acts of unprotected intercourse were averted due to the campaign. All right. That's pretty good. So this sort of shows even if campaigns don't have to have monumental effects, if they have reasonable effects and we have a very wide reach, they can have a large impact. So overall, we believe these results provide support for the efficacy of a televised-only campaign affecting behavior in young adults. We were able to achieve high exposure. Condom use and related variables seemed to change in response to the campaign. And there was a wear-off effect, and we need to be realistic about campaign effects, just like with advertising. If you notice advertisers, don't stop advertising. Coke is going and going, and they keep having new campaigns and new things happening. They pour tons of money into it. You see those messages over and over and over again. We can't just do a one-week campaign and expect that we're going to see long-term effects. So we believe that the sort of another implication of the study is that that we need to attend to effective campaign design principles, that we really have a lot of knowledge about what works in terms of campaigns, but we have to put into action and pay close attention. In that review I did, I tried to point very closely to those principles that we know work. And the more rigorous our evaluation is, it can allow us to understand more what happened with the campaign. Sometimes very good campaigns happen, the evaluation is not very good, and in the end, it's just a question mark. We don't really know if it worked or not. And I just wanted to mention that we are doing a new study now focused on delay of sex. We're working with much younger adolescents, and the aim of the campaign is to try and get them to delay their initiation of first sex by a bit which the literature suggests can greatly have them avoid many STDs and other negative consequences. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Seth. And now join me in welcoming Dr. Donna Balloon.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you here today. And I wanted to thank Vicki Rideout for inviting me. This is really wonderful to give us an opportunity to share our strategy about truth and more importantly, the evaluation. As many of you know, Truth is a national counter-marketing campaign designed to reduce youth smoking. Truth is primarily a media campaign, although it has other elements to the campaign, and most messages have been delivered through television advertisements. It relies on paid media, similar to the Truth campaign, to the Verb campaign, and the ads are placed within a typical teen programming context, that is, alongside TV programs or channels such as MTV. We also use sensation seeking as a key targeting variable to ensure that the ads are salient to our target audience, which is open to smoking, high sensation seeking youth 12 to 17. As you know, the tobacco industry is famous for creating some of the most successful brands in the world. Key brand is Marlboro. Truth was created to compete with these brands as an alternative brand that youth might otherwise use to express their rebelliousness. Ads make frequent use of facts and scientific statistics about smoking and about the tobacco industry that youth find compelling. At the same time, these facts serve to focus the youth's rebelliousness and direct it towards the tobacco industry as a way to show their identity. By using tobacco industry documents, scientific studies, and other information, the campaign exposes the lies of the tobacco industry. Youth is not an anti-smoking campaign, so it never preaches. It never tells youth not to smoke. It doesn't stigmatize smokers. It is instead an anti-tobacco campaign directed at the industry. Truth is designed as a youth-to-youth campaign. Ads are not generally put on near programs that are viewed by adults, and it's not shown in schools, and it is never branded as an American legacy product. I'd like to show you an example of one of our ads body bags. This is filmed outside Gold Mouse.
This here for you so you can see what 1,200 people actually look like.
Keep following them up, guys.
Our evaluation strategy derives from a conceptual framework which includes three phases. First, through the use of mass media, we aim to change a set of key beliefs and attitudes that are associated with youth smoking. This list of statements represents the beliefs and attitudes that our messages are specifically targeted to. Secondly, as a result of changes in these beliefs and attitudes, we expect to influence the intent not to smoke. Finally, we expect over time to see that changes in intentions to smoke result in reduced smoking results at the population level. Because Truth is the largest national youth campaign of its kind, and because of the complexities of its having been launched nationally without a control group, The truth evaluation is necessarily multifaceted. Of the many studies that we've conducted over time, I'm going to focus on two studies, one of which is based on the legacy media tracking study and one on monitoring the future data. These two studies are included in your packet today if you'd like some more details. I'm going to try and give a brief overview. Both are published in the American Journal of Public Health. The Legacy Media Tracking Survey, or better known as LMTS, is a nationally representative telephone survey designed to track awareness of and reactions to truth among our target audience, youth 12 to 24. 9 data collections with an overall sample size of 7,000. Primary purpose of this survey is to understand exposure and its relationship to the campaign set of key beliefs and attitudes. This survey provided the data for the first study, which was Getting to the Truth, Evaluating National Tobacco Campaigns. Monitoring the Future is a national school-based data collection that is collected out of the University of Michigan, looks at 8th, 10th, and 12th grade students, and it has been a data collection since 1975. Monitoring the Future monitors a broad variety of beliefs, attitudes, intentions, and behaviors, but across a broader variety of risk behaviors, including tobacco. Our first paper includes data from the end of the first year of the campaign. 3 key points I just want to include. We demonstrated the reach of the campaign to our target audience. In fact, 75% of all youth aged 12 to 17 nationwide could accurately describe the end of at least one truth ad after having heard the description of the beginning of the ad. It's a measure that we call confirmed awareness. The campaign was associated with changes in the key beliefs and attitudes I mentioned earlier. Also, we looked at tobacco-related beliefs and attitudes that were not expected to change as a result of the campaign and found that they had not changed. And this was just another way of helping to ensure that the shift in beliefs and attitudes was not the result of secular trends. Logistic regression was used to determine that the campaign was associated with changes in intentions to smoke among youth. In fact, youth with confirmed awareness of truth were 66% more likely to say that they would not smoke in the coming year. It's interesting to note that our analysis enabled us to also assess the impact of Philip Morris's Think Don't Smoke campaign. Exposure to that campaign was statistically significantly associated with a lower likelihood of youth reporting that they would not smoke in the coming year. This study controlled for numerous demographic and contextual variables, state-level anti-tobacco campaigns, and bias due to the possibility that survey responses were not provided in a private setting. Our second study, which demonstrates the impact of truth, utilized the Monitoring the Future data. From 1997 through 2002, this analysis extends our finding by demonstrating the association between exposure to the campaign and youth smoking behavior, which extends our work in terms of our intentions to smoke paper, which was the 2002 paper. So Monitoring the Future prevalence data provided us the ability to develop a pre-campaign baseline, the 1997 to 1999. And it allowed us to look at the annual rate of change in prevalence rates before the campaign, as well as during the campaign, to determine whether prevalence rates declines were accelerated after the campaign. Since Monitoring the Future does not ask the question of exposure to truth, we coded campaign exposure for each student as the cumulative number of GRPs that aired in the school's media market over the first 3 years of the campaign, which included the 210 U.S. media markets across the country. We estimated the odds of smoking as a function of exposure to the campaign while controlling for individual media market and state level variables. Using pre-campaign data, we predicted the prevalence trend in the absence of the campaign, that is setting GRPs to zero, and compared it to the actual trends to estimate the proportion of the decline attributable to truth. The difference between the actual and the predicted indicated how much lower smoking rates were as a result of the campaign. We were able to demonstrate the truth accounted for 22% of the total decline in youth smoking between 1999 and 2002. In addition, this analysis revealed a dose-response relationship between truth exposure and youth smoking rates. In a model that included all students, this effect diminished at approximately a level of 10,000 GRPs, which implies that if we had been able to redistribute the GRPs across the nation, that the impact of truth would have been higher. We continue to assess the impact of truth, with particular attention paid to the cumulative effects of the campaign. As yet, unpublished studies reveal that the association between anti-tobacco attitudes and beliefs has strengthened over the course of time. Truth is now associated with 9 key belief and attitude items, whereas in 2001, it was associated with only 5. Additional research is needed to determine whether campaign effectiveness has been impacted by changes in our media buy. We have gone from being at 70% on broadcast to 70% on cable, and that is a direct response to our declining resources. There is a discussion in some circles about whether a GRP is a GRP. And whether a GRP in 2000 is the same as a GRP in 2006, and this is obviously a question that we're trying to answer. If they are not functionally the same thing, then we need to understand how they differ and how this may be impacting our evaluation of the truth campaign. And finally, we're beginning to focus on evaluating new media channels such as podcasting, text messaging, and entertainment education, similar to the work that the Kaiser Foundation has done, all of which are being considered as future truth vehicles. So thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. And now's the time when you folks get to ask your questions of the panelists. So if you have a question, raise your hand. Somebody with a microphone will find you, and there's somebody right in the back there.
Hi, for Ms. Vallone. Thanks for a great presentation. I was wondering if your research looked in any way at, alongside having the truth PSAs, the impact at the same time, the variable of the marketing and advertising of tobacco towards youth and how that interplayed with the PSA campaign or its effects or whether the campaign was able to overcome that.
We actually do collect information in our media tracking survey about the level of exposure to what we call pro-tobacco marketing. To date, we actually haven't published anything around that. We do have one of our first look reports. I can direct you to that. But I would say that the Think Don't Smoke work is probably the most compelling, and we will be coming out with another manuscript that uses more waves of data and sort of further confirms our initial findings, which were, criticized by the tobacco industry in the justice case as being somewhat flawed. So I think it is the evidence is quite compelling that pro-tobacco marketing can be effective when it wants to be, and its prevention efforts have not been successful.
You know, it's a really interesting point because in each of the subject areas you guys are working in, the more exposure one of your viewers has to your campaign, the more media they're watching. And in each case, there are likely to be media messages that might be counter to that. So factoring that in, whether it's food advertising or sexual content in television shows or tobacco marketing and so on. So figuring out how to factor that into an evaluation is a really interesting challenge, particularly for you and your upcoming study about delaying sex. So, other questions? Yes, Vivica. If you'd introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Vivica Craig from the Institute of Medicine. My question is for Dr. Heumann. It's a two-part question. You mentioned that the VERB campaign will be ending in September 2006, and I'm wondering if you could provide for the audience just some insight on why the funding was ended and what might have been done earlier on throughout the campaign to build the support so that it wouldn't end several years after its inception. The second question is, how long do you anticipate following through the national longitudinal youth media campaign to see whether or not the lack of exposure to the VERB messages actually will lead to a curtailment in their physical activity levels?
Two really good questions. I'll answer the second one first. We are in the field now to evaluate the messages that are out there now, and so we're paralleling that. We do not plan another collection after this. Our the best evaluation would be for the campaign to have ended in April of 2006, and then for us to gather in a year from now with the campaign completely off the air and then see if there is a decline. That's one of the more powerful ways to demonstrate effectiveness and one of the things that Seth was pointing to. So we don't have the resources to do that a year from now. If we did, we would love to do that. The answer to your first question is we are a congressionally mandated and line item in the congressional budget, and we were initially authorized for 5 years. And I don't think anybody really expected us to have the kind of effects that we've had and the kind of awareness and the kind of scope that we've been able to accomplish. So this is a very tough budget year. And so we were not refunded because I think of a lot of competing priorities. We're at the end of the 5 years. And I don't know. We really worked hard over the years to get a lot of congressional support. And one of the things that was meaningful to me is that our supporters in Congress said to us, we do not dispute the value and the effectiveness of this campaign, but there are other priorities that we need to tend to. So it was really good that they believed that we were effective and believed that we were doing a great job, but there just wasn't money to fund that. Thank you for your question.
I have a quick question for you guys, which is all of you are involved in campaigns that are either entirely or at least partially paid for, where you buy the media time. Not everybody can afford to do that. What do you think is the relevance of your evaluations to groups that are relying on donated media? Seth?
Good question. Not an easy one either. The principles are still the same. You know, in order to have an effect on our audience, whatever the audience is, we have to be airing messages that the audience, there's some data to suggest that the messages will be effective with the audience, and the audience needs to actually see the messages. And so that is surely much easier when you have more resources to be able to do, A, do formative research, and B, use paid media to reach folks. But I would say, no matter what the circumstance, it's certainly much more difficult with less resources, but to strive as much as possible to be, you know, getting even some little bit of data from even one or two focus groups. What does your target audience think of your messages, number one? And number two, do your best to do the homework. Sometimes you can use, you know, I don't know, perhaps lower-cost media channels, whether it's posters or billboards or bumper stickers or something else. But the important thing is for then folks to see the messages one way or another. And if you're working with donated time, I think I mentioned we put in a strong pitch that the donated time couldn't be, you know, we probably didn't get 100% of what we wanted, but I think we got a good, because they gave us reports about both the paid and the donated. And we got some pretty good donated time in some primetime shows and things like that. So I think to make a pitch for it and to show that this stuff can work, but it's got to be put into shows and put in channels and things that are actually going to reach the audience.
And I think your efforts to bring the media partners in as partners in the beginning probably paid off in that way, too.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, our campaign, there was a previous campaign that Phil Palmgreen conducted, and he was involved in this one as well, and it was an anti-marijuana study. And that study was actually published in American Journal of Public Health, had dramatic impact on marijuana use. When we met with the television stations, we showed them those results, and we reminded them that they had a hand in producing those pretty large decreases in marijuana use. And we said, we want to test the same strategy, only with a different sort of problem behavior this time. And that buy-in, I think, really helped because, you know, we're all human beings, and I think they really did want to be a part of it and to help us out. And that was different than just going in and asking to buy time.
Right. Over here.
Hi, I'm Bob Denniston from the National Youth Anti-Drug Media Campaign. Two questions for Seth. Seth, in terms of the awareness measures, were you able to test out ghost awareness? We found generally that 10 to 12% of awareness is for ads that were never aired. So I kind of wonder about that. Who knows about those things? And then second, in terms of condom use, was that just self-reported use, or were there archival data such as condom sales or anything else to kind of support that point?
Good questions. On the first one, the ghost, thank you, the ghost exposure. Brain's not quite working that well today. I don't know what it is. On the ghost exposure, there is some evidence that we actually have underestimated our exposure rates, because in the laptop survey, we were only able to include 5 PSAs because we couldn't have people watch all 11 PSAs. It was just too much time. So we only showed people 5. So all that data I presented are only asking people about 5, but there were 11 PSAs that aired in the campaign. In the paper, actually, we did take this – we sort of did an analysis that suggested that in some cases, as you're suggesting, folks may say, oh, I've seen that one, when they really haven't. They've seen something similar perhaps. And so in the paper, we adjusted our exposure rates down about 10%. Even if that's the case, we still had quite high exposure. And as I mentioned, it probably all comes out in the wash because we were not able to ask folks about more than half the PSAs. And the other question had to do with the self-report. We tried, because self-report is self-report, and it's something, you know. And we did a time series on, asked people about their condom use and tracked it over time, which of course is much more stronger than sort of after the campaign asking, after seeing that campaign, did you change your behavior? So it was a rigorous design, but certainly it would have been better if possible to have. And we tried to do condom sales stuff. We looked into that, and it was just too difficult in terms of so many different stores keeping sales data from different time periods. And we had hoped to do something like that, but it just wasn't possible. But thank you for the questions.
Rosemary? Right here, Teresa?
Okay. Rosemary Chalk from the National Academies. Seth, did your team at all consider in the research design including some kind of a reinforcement cohort where you would have supplemental messages, consistent messaging coming in from additional sources beyond just the public service ads, either through the health department, through healthcare providers or pharmacies? And if you had done something like that, would you like to hypothesize about any possible effects that may have been produced?
Yeah, thanks. In this study, as I mentioned, we wanted to test media only, television only, actually. And so we purposefully excluded any additional channels. In the original design, actually, we were going to have a booster campaign in Lexington. And so one thing Phil Palmgreen did in his previous study was, after the one campaign ended a year later, you had another campaign. And as marijuana use was going back up, instead it started to come down again. And actually, for budgetary reasons, we weren't able to do that, to have a second campaign. So we did stick to the one channel because we thought it was important to try and demonstrate, you know, if that one channel could be effective television only. But certainly using more components has the potential to be really effective in terms of synergy and other kinds of things.
Well, I think it's a fascinating part of what you did, because that has traditionally been just anathema for a public education campaign, to say that you would do media by itself. I mean, it's always been that we have to have a grassroots component, something on the ground, and so on and so forth. And to set out to specifically test the notion of just a media campaign, I think is just fascinating. And the other thing I was going to say is, in terms of ghost awareness, your effect size might have been higher if you were able to eliminate the people who were falsely saying they had been exposed to the campaign, which would be interesting. I've never seen anything like what Legacy did, where you actually had the respondents tell you how the ad ended when you tell them the beginning. I mean, that's a tough measure of exposure. That was really fascinating. I saw a question somewhere over here. Yeah.
Thank you, that was my... Hi, I'm Alex Losovich from American Institute for Research. Actually, why didn't you use confirmed awareness measure? Why did you use
That's a question for me.
Yeah.
Well, we decided to use, since we did using the laptop-based procedure where we, basically what we did is we did random digit dialing. We screened people that had to have certain criteria to be in the study, particularly being sexually active and the right age range and things. And then we used survey research centers both at University of Kentucky and University of Tennessee. And what they do is they contact folks and they'll either come to your home or they'll meet them in different places to do the survey. And we did all the surveying on laptop computers. That for the procedure that truth is really fascinating. That's not something that we had thought of, but we did what Dr. Palmgren did in his previous study, which I think is a pretty rigorous way to do it, to show them the actual ad. And we asked them, have you ever seen this? How many times? And we also collected other data about what they thought about the ads. So we thought that was a pretty good way to go about it. But that the confirmed awareness is certainly an interesting and, you know, potentially higher threshold measure.
Mm-hmm. Right here.
Sandy Calvert, Georgetown University. A couple of things. One, can you each give us an estimate about how much per year it would cost to run your campaign or actually how much it is costing to do it? And then secondly, with something like the Verb campaign, and I'm sure the others of you had the same sort of ideas, is there certain sensitive ages? You know, I'm seeing that younger kids are more influenced by Verb. Is there a reason why the younger kids are more influenced? And given limited resources, are there certain ages that each area should be targeting for maximum effectiveness?
Our first year's appropriation was $125 million. And after that, it went down successively. Right now, we figure we could run the campaign with that level of awareness, that big boost of awareness that we got, and the brand likability and resonance that's out there on about $60 million a year. We did get a lot of donated media. The first year, the media by itself was about $51 million, and we got about $70 million in kind for tours and the school promotions. So that's the answer to that. And then, you know, we think that we actually adjusted the media buy in subsequent years so we could better reach that older target, and we changed a little bit of the messaging so that it would appeal and appeal up a little bit, because actually the younger kids look up to the older kids and model them. And we think that the 9 and 10-year-olds were just affected. The campaigns really, Verb really emphasizes fun and having fun with your friends, and that physical activity is a cool thing to do. And it just resonated better that first year with the younger kids and with girls, and maybe girls' sociability made that a little bit more resonating too. So we've adjusted the media buy and the messaging in response to that. As far as other groups to be targeting, of course, we target this age because habits established at this age for adolescents and young adolescents is more likely to be maintained as kids go into adolescence and then into young adulthood. So that's why this is particularly an important group for physical activity, and also that parents are still able to influence their kids to be physically active. So that made a good secondary audience for us.
That corner.
Michelle Ward-Brent from RTI International. This is a quick question for Seth. You mentioned your surprise that the condom campaign was airing in a conservative southern area. Did the station experience any backlash at all, either from community groups or advertising?
Actually, no. I don't think we. I don't think we got. I think there was one, perhaps in Knoxville, there was like one phone call from a parent or something like that who saw it come on. We did have one or two, as we were working with the stations, we did have one or two up front before anything was aired that were concerned. There was one station that seemed to have a much more conservative station manager. We got a lot of questions about why isn't this an abstinence campaign, and they considered not being a part of it. And so we had to work with them, and a couple of them were a little bit tougher than others. But in the end, there might have been one or two phone calls through the whole campaign at the most.
This gentleman right here.
Hi, this is for CDC. Did you have a focus group? Did you have focus group results that encouraged you to exclude nutrition from your Verb campaign?
We did extensive amounts of formative research. Others on the panel talked about that, and I did not. But we
absolutely tested every, we did a lot of exploratory research to find out what the motivators were for this age group and what were the barriers for them, and built that sort of thing. That's one of the ways we knew it was going to be a can-do, a positive campaign and not a health, this is a healthy thing for you to do campaign. So we did exploratory research. We did a lot of concept testing and message testing as well. What was the other thing you asked, the formative?
Question of whether you could have stressed nutrition.
Right. People have come to us since we've been out there and said, can we make this also a nutrition campaign, nutrition message? But we think that it has to be a single message campaign. In fact, we started out at the beginning because our congressional mandate was to affect positive activities, and we were initially a positive activity, encouraging this age group to be positively active, including physical activity, and it was too broad. We could not get good advertising and messages that really could target this group with a single message. So that single messaging concept is something I think probably everybody up here would agree to. So we couldn't make it a nutrition campaign or a some other risk behavior. Keith.
I'm Keith Scarborough with the Association of National Advertisers. We're one of the groups that sponsors the Ad Council, and they've done, obviously, PSAs on a whole range of issues for a number of years. I'd be interested in any comments you have about comparing the Ad Council effectiveness of their campaigns versus what you've been involved with. Do you think the Ad Council PSAs, obviously they have a substantial amount of resources behind them. Are they more or less effective than other campaigns that you've been involved with?
I'll just take a crack at that. We actually have a campaign that we work with the Ad Council. It's called Don't Pass Gas, and it's about secondhand smoke. I think the real problem is the placement. You don't really get, complete leverage of where you want to place your ads. And so what you have is you have GRPs that are going to run at 4 o'clock in the morning or at hours where your target audience is not going to be present. I mean, it's the problem of not having the ability to firmly decide where that placement is going to be. So I think on some level it's unfair of a comparison to particularly where Truth, we actually buy it, we place it on in a teen context. We have all that leverage. So I think that they're very effective. But I think you need to take into consideration that the mechanism through which they air is not under the control of the campaign developer, and that compromises their ability to reach that audience as effectively.
Seth or Marion, want to comment or anything? No? Okay. Did you have a comment earlier? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I'll come over here next.
I'm still interested also, Susanna Fox from the Pew Research Center, I'm still interested in how much it costs to run the other two campaigns. But my question actually was regarding Verb. I'm interested in the Yellow Ball campaign and what the uptake was for the kids trying to move them online and if it was a success or a failure. Why do you think that?
Well, our campaign is probably the simplest because we don't have a nice big national campaign. It was a regional campaign. And it's interesting because we were able to do it and have high exposure, intensive campaigns. But we've looked into doing maybe another project, a three-city campaign, or going to larger cities. We may be able to, but it gets very expensive. One reason we were able to have high exposure and pull this off was these markets are smaller and the media is not nearly as expensive as if you tried to do this in Chicago, New York City, that kind of thing. I don't have exact figures off the top of my head, but I believe, I know for sure that Knoxville was more expensive than Lexington. It's a slightly bigger market. I think we spent about $150,000 on the Lexington campaign and maybe closer to $200,000 on Knoxville. That's my guess. Oh, the Knoxville thing I don't have time to go into, but there was a second campaign. And so $150,000 to $200,000 for airtime.
Over here we had... question. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. we'll finish here first.
Sure. In the early years of the Truth Campaign, we spent about $100 million per year, and that was media buy as well as production costs. We probably spend about half that right now, and we've changed, as I mentioned, we've changed the proportion of GRPs on broadcast versus cable. In terms of the ages of the campaign, I mean, I think these are some of the things that we're wrestling, which is we built a brand, and we see brand equity and cumulative effects of GRPs. And so what we see is the strongest effects among 12th graders because they've had essentially 4 years of exposure to the brand. So when we look at 8th graders, we would argue that it's a little cerebral for a 6th grader. So I think that that's one of the challenges of evaluating campaigns with kids because they're going through these different developmental stages. I will tell you, 10th graders are really difficult for us because almost despite whatever we say, the rebelliousness kicks in. But it does look like by 12th grade, it really does have a very strong effect.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up on the cost question.
I'll be quick.
I keep cutting off the panel. I'm really sorry. Go ahead.
And just to answer quickly your yellow ball question, we hope about 2 million kids will pick it up and do something with it. They're blogging about it, and they're saying wonderful things on the yellowball.com website. There are 21 million tweens in this country, so that's our target audience. We're reaching 17 million of them if you figure about a 75% awareness. So just another little thing that we look at in terms of cost. So we figure about $3 a year it costs us to reach these kids and to be moving the needle on physical activity.
$3 per kid?
Per child, right. That's very, very rough, though. Very rough.
Sorry, ma'am.
Okay. Could you tell us what the overall cost of the condom campaign is, not just the ad buys? And also, we'd be very interested to know, I think a lot of people here, the cost of the evaluation efforts.
Yeah.
Wow, well, I should have picked through the budget before I came today to, this was, as I mentioned, a project funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, which is part of NIH. The entire grant was $2.8 million, but folks that know about this kind of thing know that a big chunk of that goes to the university that takes the grant. So just for accepting the grant, University of Kentucky got some money. I don't know how much, maybe $800,000 or something like that. It's like 43, something around 40% of the grant. And so basically you're talking about probably about $2 million, which includes all the evaluation, all the airtime. We developed 5 PSAs for the campaign, which came out, I think, pretty strong given the small budget we had. Folks at NIH also know that salaries to pay graduate research assistants, folks working on the project, is typically the biggest line item. But that gives you a sense of the amount of money and the number of things that it was used for.
And what did you pay to produce a PSA?
We worked with a guy named Mike Kilborn. He has this group called RTV Incorporated in Lexington, and we paid about $20,000 per PSA, which is like dirt cheap compared to. My understanding is that Truth has easily spent maybe $1 million on one PSA and has fantastic spots. But again, I wish I had showed you guys one or two of them because they came out, I think, pretty good given the budget.
Good. Yes, and back.
Oh, did you want me to answer the how much the
Oh, yes, sure. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Our evaluation costs roughly $2 million a year, so that's far less than the 10% that they recommend on the for evaluation of a program. So, but that does include the formative research, which is considerable, and the concept testing, all the focus groups for that is a considerable, and the tracking study. And in addition to the big survey that we're doing, we have added two additional surveys. Another cohort that started in 2004, and then a new cross-sectional in 2006, and that's to tease out time and sample bias. Once kids are in a cohort for 5 or 6 years, you begin to wonder whether calling them on the phone is part of the intervention. So to try to tease that out, we mounted additional surveys.
In terms of our evaluation cost, I would estimate about $5 to $8 million, but we've been on the air for 6 years, so it's really been quite a monumental effort, but I would estimate that as per year. But I just wanted to make one point, which is I sort of encourage folks to look around and see what other data collections are actually being mounted, either in your state or your locality, and really try and think creatively about how you might either piggyback onto onto a data collection that's already in the field, or use one of which you're trying to change your behavior or an attitude, because that's one of the ways that we actually saved money, was really by using monitoring the future, because data collection for us has been one of the most expensive components of the evaluation.
But you then had to correlate that free monitoring the future data with gross rating points through Nielsen. And did that cost you money? Or
no, actually, remember, since we buy the media, we know where the gross rating points are.
So we have that data. That are relying on donated media, though, they would have to purchase, unless it was through an organization like the Ad Council that provides them with those data, they might have to purchase that.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. And I think comment from the Ad Council, since their name has been invoked, and then we will go for the last question to you.
Hi, it's Tony Foligno, Research and Evaluation of the Ad Council. And we do rely on donated media, and it is a very good question. And I think issue placement is an important one. We do get about $29 million per campaign per year across all media, and it's usually about a $700,000 investment. So that's one way to do ROI, but we're also very committed to doing tracking studies, pre-post, and everything. I'd be happy to share that info too.
Great.
Hi, I'm Roshan Matthew with Connect for Kids, and I was wondering, this question's for Marianne, I was wondering, when you said that you were happy with your study in its ability to address a lower socioeconomic population, I was wondering what it was about your study that you think was able to target that group.
We do put almost everything on cable, and cable reaches, we think, about 76% of the households in this country. But by going into schools, one of the things we looked at this last year is that among lower income groups, we had more awareness coming from schools. And so we were targeting more schools. So we think that may be one reason. Another is because we used these ethnic-specific contractors that really understood their audiences, we've actually gotten a good sense that the Hispanic and the Spanish-speaking households are one group that we're reaching especially well. And no group is really falling below what our goal was. So, that's one of the things that we're looking at, is trying to understand that. One of the things is because we're pushing free time play, that it's not something that we're seeing effects in that. It doesn't have the same barriers that organized activity does for low-income households. So, and we're also reaching a lot of parents, and sometimes low-income parents as well, and maybe that's just encouraging parents to make more opportunities available, take their kids to park, whatever, to have free time play.
Okay, thank you. We're going to wrap it up now. I do want to say, if you want to hang around and talk to one another, there's coffee and cookies out in the lobby. Please feel free to do so. This is part of a series of functions that we're doing on social marketing, public service advertising, public education campaigns. So if you have thoughts or ideas of what you'd most like to hear about, topics you think we should cover, please let me know. A couple years ago, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a content study about public service advertising on television. We looked at the amount of time that's donated to PSAs, the amount of time dedicated to paid PSAs, corporate PSAs, the time of day they run, and so on. We are currently in the field redoing that. So one of these functions, we will have new data to share with you on that probably next year sometime. I want to thank my panelists, Donna Vallone, Seth Knorr, and Marianne Heumann, so much for coming and sharing your expertise with us. Thank you. Thank you all, too.